Okay, good morning everyone. So welcome to the last lecture of the class. And so we're going to continue with the theme of collective behavior, but focusing today predominantly on human collective behavior. And so first we're going to start with a very, very, very brief history of human culture. So much human culture is characterized by what's called the ratchet effect of technological advancement. And I'm talking about everything from utilization of stone tools to modern technologies today. And so what is a ratchet? Well, a ratchet is a mechanical device whereby once it's moved past a certain point, it doesn't go back. So the idea here is that technologies can build upon existing technologies and get increasingly sophisticated. But one question we can ask ourselves is how long did it take for major changes to occur in technology, especially in the history of hominids, of humans? And also, do these technological advancements happen very regularly, as shown in this video, or do we get sudden jumps in technologies? And finally, I want to ask how this is related to the human brain, the evolution of the large size of the human brain. Okay, so if we look at human culture, one of the best ways we can gain insights is by looking at stone tools. Of course, these are particularly robust and therefore are found in many archaeological sites. There could, of course, have been other technologies which have been lost. And so if we look across time here, so this is millions of years ago, down to 2.5, we see here Homo habilis, who utilized relatively simple, like hammer stones and anvils, much like I showed you with the chimpanzees, but we still have something a bit more sophisticated where bits of the object have been broken off to create sharp edges. As we go forward in time to Homo ergaster, we see, well, you know, we've jumped forwards over 2 million years, and what we see is actually surprisingly similar to what we see here. Not much has really changed. We jump forwards to Homo erectus again. I mean, minor changes, but nothing absolutely dramatic. Neanderthals. And finally, Cro-Magnon man. And here we're suddenly seeing stuff that's completely different. We're seeing objects that are being combined together to make metatools. And what's really staggering is how little has changed over this period of time. These are millions of years. And so if we think about the evolution of the brain, one may think that tools may have been a driving factor in the evolution of large brains, or that as brains get larger, you're capable of making more and more sophisticated tools. But you can see here that the brains actually evolved and reached its current size, the same size as our brains today, and yet we do not see a massive change in the stone tools that were used. So it doesn't seem that tool use itself drove brain evolution. Because this brain, of course, is incredibly costly, both energetically and also due to childbirth. So the Alderwan and Acheulean hand axe technologies lasted without significant changes for over 1 million years each. And so we can look at millions of years of our ancestors' what are called lithic technologies, and we don't really see this evidence of ratcheting. And this is clearly fundamentally different to our societies in which we live. I mean, we see massive technological advances in a period of a few years. Here we're looking at millions of years. Yet, the brain has reached its modern size. 500,000 years ago, brain size increased significantly, and 200,000 years ago, it reached what are considered modern levels. And so man is thought, oh, there's good evidence that man evolved in Africa and spread from there. And it's thought that modern humans left Africa around 70,000 years ago. And after that, there's an innovation explosion. We suddenly see incredibly sophisticated tool use. For example, if we go back to 25,000 to 10,000 years ago, numerous important techniques and technologies have suddenly emerged. There's a much wider range of shapes, finer craftsmanship, and the first use of non-stone materials. And also, as I mentioned before, composite tools, tools that are created by combining things together and tying them together, for example. And this is about the time when Europe was colonized by modern humans. So was Europe colonized by modern humans at this time because our ancestors suddenly had this capability? Or was there some coevolution involved there? It's not clear. So if we now move from 10,000 to 7,000 years ago, remember before we looked at 2 million years and nothing really changed. So now we're looking at very fine units of time. Now stone tools become very sophisticated through processes like grinding. There are containers made from leather and pottery. Pottery is fundamentally something completely new, where you create it from scratch to hold, for example, water. A new topology, a surface around a void. Sounds obvious to us, but it had never been seen prior to this point. And the assembly of small parts into large objects, rather than just taking a large object and breaking bits off it to make it smaller. We're now seeing much more sophisticated use. And closely related is the correction of errors by undoing work and returning to a point earlier in the manufacturing sequence. So if you're making something out of, say, two or three different pieces, if one of those pieces doesn't work, the other two are okay. So they broke things down into a series of stages such that everything wasn't dependent on the same process. And this separation of stages is then essential for use of metals and so forth. At around 10,000 years ago, there was a major transition in evolutionary history. There was the sudden adoption of agriculture. So instead of just going foraging for what's out there in forests, now humans are actually planting seeds, deliberately harvesting. Like this is a sickle from 3000 BC. And this Neolithic agricultural revolution is one of the most significant shifts in the adaptation of human populations. Suddenly humans are eating different things. They're also beginning to modify the plants and select for plants that are better to eat. And this is extremely interesting because, of course, there's now going to be a coevolution between the genetics of humans and these cultural aspects. So what's called the gene-culture coevolution. So for example, if you start agriculture, then this can create selection for different types of metabolism. In particular, if you look at the domestication of livestock and the subsequent use of milk, societies, humans, are not naturally lactose tolerant. We had to evolve to be lactose tolerant, and that was associated very, very clearly with the domestication of cattle and the use of cattle. Parts of the world that didn't have this domestication of cattle are still lactose intolerant today. So lactose tolerance is an example of very strong selection, very strong natural selection in humans. It occurred very quickly. And there's a significant geographical coincidence between high diversity in cattle milk genes, the locations of Neolithic cattle farming sites, we're talking around 5,000 or a bit more years ago, and present-day lactose tolerance. So this evolutionary process happened very, very fast for obvious adaptive benefits. You can get a huge amount of nutrition from milk. And so when we think of the evolution of culture and the evolution of humans in particular, we can't just think about the gene pool. We can't just think about culture. We have to think about the interplay between these processes. And so we're very familiar with genetic inheritance, of course, the substrate of natural selection. We also have seen that there can be cultural inheritance. We can have the transfer of sophisticated tools from generation to generation. That's not occurring genetically. Of course, there is this gene component. There is this modified selection and development, this horizontal transfer here. And so we need to understand all of those processes to understand our own evolutionary history. So the transition from just hunting-gathering to actually creating farms and producing food and domesticating both plants and animals has had a profound effect on the technology, the demography, the social organization, and the biology of humans. We were changed really very dramatically in a very short period. So not much changed for millions of years. The brains got larger and larger and larger, then suddenly, bang, there's this sudden change in humans. So somewhere between a few hundred and a couple of thousands of human genes show signs of very recent and very strong selection. In the last sort of 40,000 years, we've been under intense selection. I gave the example, of course, of metabolism of lactose in cow's milk, a classic example. But there are many others. There's resistance to diseases such as malaria was strongly selected for in this time period. There's very strong evidence that massive changes occurred in neural functioning. Remember, brain size didn't change, but there's very strong evidence that neural functioning changed dramatically. So it's not just about the size of the brains, it's also about how the neurons and how the circuits interact. And if you're interested in this, there's a very nice review by Kevin Leyland and collaborators. And I don't want you to remember what I'm going to show you in the next slide. It's just to give you an example of the very diverse range of functions and phenotypes that there's now very good evidence that have been under very strong selection in this time period. That culture was associated with very strong selection. You can see at the top there digestion of milk and dairy products, metabolism of carbohydrates, starch, proteins, lipids, alcohol metabolism. All evolved very suddenly and quickly. You've got detoxification of plant secondary compounds associated again with the emergence of agriculture. Pathogen resistance, possibly associated with humans being more closely associated in more sophisticated societies, you then have strong evolution against disease transfer. Hot and cold tolerance as humans moved into a wider range. Externally visible phenotypes, changes in skin pigmentation, eye color. But very importantly, nervous system changes, direct evidence for brain functioning and development, language skills and vocal learning, skeletal development, and also tooth enamel and jaw. So direct evidence of natural selection in humans. But what's missing from this consideration of the emergence of culture, these sudden changes? Well, we haven't considered language. So anatomically, humans seemed to have all of the physical apparatus required for language about 300,000 years ago. However, it's thought that language didn't evolve until around 100,000 years ago. And genes that are known to be essential for both the production and the comprehension of speech, such as FOXP2, only underwent its last mutation within this type of period. And the humans that have mutations in FOXP2 lose their ability to speak and lose their ability to comprehend speech. And at around the same time that we think that language evolved, these final mutations that then allowed the brain to produce and comprehend forms of language, around the same time, we also see production of art. And so this is indicative that language was important, sort of storytelling and so forth. And so some argue that this gave modern hominids the genetic edge to successfully disperse from Africa at approximately that time. But it's not entirely clear what's cause and what's effect. And if we look, for example, at the human brain, we see regions that have really expanded, the regions associated with the language have really expanded compared, for example, to our most close relatives, bonobo chimpanzees. In particular, this region called Broca's region. And there's also an area, a mirror neuron area, that's considered important for comprehending speech. But the important point to note is that even though our brains were already the same size, there were dramatic modifications in internal structure associated with cultural processes and the emergence of language. And so perhaps, you know, the processes of imitation, which are so strong in humans, you know, predisposed us to being able to have these advanced abilities. And so if we think about the evolution of humans, of course, we naturally think about teams as well. Right? So it's not these individuals in isolation making technologies. It's individuals working together in groups, passing on information to their children, and then to their children's children. And so fundamentally, collective behavior, group dynamics, have been essential for the evolution of modern humans. But it's only very recently that people have been able to address scientifically what we really mean by collective behavior in humans. And what do we mean by the complex problem-solving capabilities that we speculate groups may have? So if we think for a moment about the human brain, we think often of individual intelligence. And there's a very rich history of the study of individual intelligence. So-called generalized intelligence. What does this mean? It means that if you tend to be good at some tasks, some intellectual tasks such as problem solving, you tend also on average to be good at other cognitive tasks. These things tend to be correlated within humans. And this is known as Spearman's G factor, this generalized intelligence. This chap here is a very famous statistician. And this is used all the time. You've all heard of IQ tests. You're all thinking, you know, when you're at university, you're kind of being tested in terms of your individual intellectual capabilities. But if we think about reality, if you go out there in the real world, very few people are isolated from others. People tend to work together. And yet, this ability or collective intelligence has only rarely been studied. And we know almost nothing about this. Yet one could speculate that it also must have been very important in the evolution of humans and is important today. So generalized intelligence refers to this existence of broad mental capacity. So you can sort of think about it in the following way. People that tend to be good at perceptual or reasoning, are also good at spatial tasks, verbal tasks, and so on. And so it was this realization that there tends to be a correlation caused Spearman to suggest that there is such a thing as IQ, as individual intelligence. And this was around 1904. And really, I think people have become overly obsessed with the individual characteristics or trying to quantify these factors. What about in groups? We're highly social animals. Is there evidence of a general collective intelligence in groups? And how does that relate to individual intelligence? To make a well-functioning group, can we just put people together with high individual intelligence? Will they make better decisions? Who knows? Can we isolate a small set of tasks that's predictive of group performance over a broader range? So can you do a sort of collective IQ test, which would then tell you this group is going to be good at lots of different tasks? And does collective intelligence, or a C factor, have predicted validity beyond individual intelligence? Or is it just the combined individual intelligence gives the group its intelligence? And so, while generalized individual intelligence, you know, came about around 1904, it's only been in the last 10 years that people have started to ask whether humans exhibit collective intelligence. So very, very recently. So can we use this information to build a better science of human groups? And so I'm going to show you this paper here. So this is actually the very first and possibly the most important paper in the field, published in 2010, so less than 10 years ago. And it's a great paper, so I urge you to take a look at this if you're interested in this topic. But I'll take you through the main results now. So they wrote, by analogy with individual intelligence, we define a group's collective intelligence, C, as the general ability of the group to perform a wide variety of tasks. They gave multiple different types of challenges to these groups. For example, a video game in which they had to play together as a team to design collectively architectural objects, buildings. And what's really interesting here is that, yes, some groups were very good at some of these tasks, and some groups weren't very good at these tasks. And the groups that tended to be good at one task tended to be good at other tasks. Those that weren't good tended to not be good at other tasks. But it was not related to the average member intelligence or the maximum intelligence of any member in the group. It was something different. So they actually conducted 10 different tasks, and they really did find there was something about the group that meant it was good at these tasks. You could not decompose this group or predict which groups were going to be good or bad based upon the individual intelligence of group members. That's very important to remember that fact. So consistently, it was the group's collective intelligence that could explain their ability to perform tasks well. So what predicts collective intelligence of groups? I've already just told you it's not individual intelligence. So what on earth could it be? So it's not the average IQ, intellectual quotient of members of the group. It's not the maximum IQ. It's not like there's some super brain in that group that makes the whole group good. It's not personality. It's not motivation. It's not how strongly they were motivated. They could vary that. It wasn't group satisfaction. It's not like the, you know, people felt that they were doing badly or well. Turned out it was all about communication. The network of communication in the group. Groups in which one or a few individuals dominated conversation and others did not speak much performed very poorly. Those where communication was fair, equal, egalitarian, equal among all the members, everyone had a say, everyone had the opportunity to speak, those were the groups that performed extremely well. So it's really an emergent property of the network of communication. If you have an effective network of communication, the group performs well, independently of the quality of the individual members. The network, in actual fact, turned out to be way more important. And collective intelligence was also found to increase with what's called increasing social sensitivity of the group members. So not something that's typically measured. I'm sure many of you, if not every one of you, has never been tested for social sensitivity. You're tested for all sorts of quantitative reasoning, but you're never tested in how do you work well in a team or in a group. So social sensitivity tests are like this. You have to see from this limited information whether this person is playful, comforting, irritated, or bored. And so individuals that are good at solving this problem tend to be great team players. But also, it increases massively with the proportion of females in the group. Women are much, much better able to discern these subtle social effects than are men. And so simply increasing the proportion of women in a group increases the collective intelligence of a group. And this is extremely consistent among many different tasks. So perhaps the lesson to men within groups is to really not vocalize as much as they naturally would, to let groups communicate, to let individuals communicate. But currently, you know, the only advice people can give in terms of making good teams is maximize the number of proportion of women. And there's really no advantage to even having a single man within these groups. And so we can also start thinking about what's the role of gender in other types of collective decisions in humans. So this is work that Simon Garnier at the back and I did some years ago, where we were interested in subconscious aspects of detecting terrorist reconnaissance activity within crowded environments. This was prior to the Olympics, so there were great concerns in London. There were great concerns about terrorist activity. And so we had actors within the crowd subtly manipulating the crowd's behavior. They were performing suspicious behavior, like taking notes and apparently surreptitiously filming people within the crowd. And you could see that we developed software to track the motion not just of all the pedestrians, this was in a railway station in London, but also to work out who's looking at whom. We did this work in a shopping street in Oxford, where I was based at the time, and also in a train station in London. And what we found was that there's social contagion of where you tend to look. So if I suddenly look this way, you're likely to copy my gaze. And we found that in the shopping street, compared to non-suspicious control individuals, we found that within a close range, people would look more often at these suspicious individuals than would be expected by chance. No one ever reported them to the police or did anything about it, so-called bystander apathy. But conducting exactly the same experiment in a railway station in London, we found the opposite effect. Now people would tend to avoid looking at suspicious individuals. They would actively avoid looking at them. And so we were confused. Like, what's going on here? Why are we getting different results? This one seems intuitive. You look more often at suspicious individuals, you copy the gaze of others, so it means you detect them more accurately. But that can't be the case in the train station. And so if we broke the crowd down to male and female, we found that in the shopping street scenario, both males and females would look more often at the suspicious individuals. But if we look at the train station, we now see that females behave in exactly the same way. They look more often at the suspicious individuals. But now males have inverted their behavior. They are now looking much less at the suspicious individuals than at control individuals. Why might this be? Well, this train station was in rush hour. It happened to be male-dominated. There were many more males than females during this time. And so this male effect dominates the overall population effect. But what's possible is that perhaps because our suspicious individuals were always male, because, I mean, it's difficult to do these experiments, and that was a compromise we had to make, perhaps when males are in very close proximity to other males, they will tend to avert their gaze from them to sort of avoid conflict, is possibly what's going on here. But the important point is that this social influence is extremely important. And so this is reminiscent of the video that I've previously shown you about this chap in the elevator who's unaware that the other individuals here are in on the act. So this individual is not aware that he is copying those around him. So again, you know, as we showed in the crowded environments, we all are being subtly manipulated by other individuals. We're not aware that this is happening. So how far does this go in our lives? How strong is this type of social influence? So for example, in relationships, how strongly influenced do you think you are by social factors when choosing a partner? So there's a very nice paper where a man was apparently consorted by or associated with a woman, but the woman was an actor, and they could change the attractiveness of this woman from low attractive to medium attractive to high attractive. The attractiveness is rated beforehand independently and tends to be relatively consistent among individuals. Now, if the man himself is objectively unattractive, like if women rank this man, they objectively find this man unattractive. But if he is seen with a high attractive woman, there's a much stronger likelihood that people will view him as more attractive. So people are strongly, in this case women, are strongly skewed by the attractiveness of a partner in their objective assessment of is this man attractive or not, or how one rates his attractiveness. And this effect even continued with medium or high attractive men, but the effect tended to be less strong. They did not do the experiment the other way around, which would have been pretty interesting. But there is another experiment where, again, it's rating this man's attractiveness. And you have two scenarios, one with this woman who's not even looking at him. You can even see the cut here. But the woman has a neutral expression or a happy expression. People are very strongly influenced. They will find the top individual more attractive than the bottom individual. So women here really are influenced by this. This time they also did ask men to judge the attractiveness. And for men it was inverted. Perhaps jealousy, who knows? But men find the top individual now to be less attractive than the bottom individual. So it just shows that these are relatively strong effects. They could happen in many aspects of our lives, and yet pretty much all of us are unaware of this because these are subconscious decisions that we're making. So what about other aspects of social copying behavior? Well, fads and fashions is a good example. As we see over the eras, you know, these choices in clothing might seem ridiculous to us now. But at the time, of course they weren't. This was the cool thing. You know, in the future, you guys are going to look ridiculous, presumably. What about markets? Well, there's a huge social component. You know, is the market going to go up? Is the market going to go down? A huge social component of how people feel, whether they feel positive or negative about the markets. And this can cause cascading effects, like sudden collapses in the market. Because suddenly, if others are selling, you want to sell before things get worse, which causes others to sell before things get worse, which can cause an entire market to collapse. Markets can collapse based on misinformation. What about politics? I mean, how on earth did that happen? We'll come back to that later. Okay, so let's think now about literature. How many of you have read Harry Potter? A good proportion of you. Okay, so it's a very famous book. Is it actually good, though? It was rejected, after all, by eight publishers, famously rejected by eight publishers. Is it actually a good book? I read it and I didn't think so. But maybe that's just my opinion. Because it became somewhat of a success. I think she's like second richest woman in Britain, or most rich woman in Britain now. I don't know why. It's rubbish. But this is not rubbish. This is awesome. But it was rejected by United Artists and Universal and launched a billion-dollar franchise. So if we were to turn time back, would Harry Potter still be a successful book? Or was it some quirk that occurred that if we reversed time, wouldn't happen again? Well, the same with Star Wars. How would we expect social influence to change the predictability of these processes? Presumably, social influence was very important for the spreading of Harry Potter, people recommending it to others to read. And so this has been studied scientifically by a friend and colleague of mine, Matt Salganik, at Princeton University. Of course, we can't really reverse time. But you can do something kind of clever. I like this experiment. And so when he was at Columbia University, before he moved to Princeton, he set up with Duncan Watts what's called the Music Lab, right? So you could log on to this website, and you could listen to music. Now, I'm not sure whether you can read the names of these bands in capital letters at the top there, but I bet you've never heard of any of these bands. And that's for a reason. These are all unsigned acts, so you don't have any prior belief as to whether they're going to be good or bad. You've got very limited information before you listen to the song. And so you get to listen to this music for free, and then you rate the song, much like we do on iTunes or Amazon or whatever. You know, I love it, 5 stars all the way down to 1 star, I hate it. And so we use this rating all the time. How many of us go to the App Store or iTunes or whatever and look at the ratings that others have given? So you'd think in environments where there's social information, you're going to be better, it's going to be faster and more accurate at determining what's good music and what's crap. But the very cool thing that they did in this experiment is they had a world in which individuals did not have any social information. So you just have lots, and there's thousands of people joining. And they just independently, without any social information, rank the music. Right? And the incentive to do this is you can freely download it once it's ranked. However, in the social influence condition, based upon the IP address of the computer you log in with, unbeknown to you, you are put into one of 8 different worlds. So it's like we can create suddenly 8 different worlds, all with the same composition of people, they're all the same demographics, there's thousands of people in each world, and so you'd think that if you were going to reverse time and run time again, each of these worlds should be pretty similar in terms of their choices of best songs, worst songs, and so forth. So you're going to look at the charts, so to speak, and these are the worlds in which you can see the stars that others have put down there. And this is a little bit messy, but let me just explain to you what this shows. What this shows, these are social worlds. What they discovered was that the very, very best songs, that little top cluster there, tended to be very correlated between the different worlds. The very worst songs tended to be correlated. But in the middle, it's absolutely more or less random which songs are considered to be good. So you have a song that's, you know, second top of the charts in one world and third from the bottom in another. This is after many, many, many listens. And so they found that increasing the strength of social influence actually made it much less predictable which songs were going to reach the top of the charts and which ones were going to fail. The increased inequality of success. So the social influence really removed people's objective ability to rate these songs. Because in the independent world, people were more or less in agreement. In the social worlds, they were vastly different. Each world was different to every other because of the social influence. And it was less and less predictable which songs were going to be considered top chart toppers and which ones were going to go to the bottom of the charts. So social influence, again, was not amplifying objective quality. It was randomly selecting for some songs to be considered good and others to be considered badly, even though objectively that wasn't the case in the independent world. And of course, people are unaware of this. They really believe that song to be better. And in another world, they believe that song to be rubbish. It's remarkable. Okay, what about this picture here? How many of you have seen this picture? I'm sure all of you have seen it, come on. But have anyone seen it in reality, in the Louvre? I mean, this is what it's going to look like. And they're not going to be cameras, it's just going to be phones, people taking pictures of it. And I've often wondered, you know, I love Leonardo da Vinci's work, but is this really a good painting? Why is this considered so important? Why do you have to go through the crowds to get access to this painting? So how did it happen? Because look at it. I mean, again, objectively, I would ask you to really look at that and go, is that painting the best painting you've ever seen, even by that artist? It's not very good. And in actual fact, until 1900, it was not well known at all. But then it was stolen. And that was all over the papers. That was in all the cafes of Paris at the time. And things got even more interesting. Because a famous French poet who'd once called for the Louvre to be burnt down came under suspicion and was arrested. And he then tried to implicate another friend of his, Pablo Picasso, as having stolen it. So the papers were full of this. Everyone was talking about it. Suddenly you couldn't get away from the Mona Lisa. In actual fact, it's very basic. An employee stole it by going into the building during regular hours, then hiding in a broom closet, and then going and stealing it. So suddenly, this painting, if this had never happened, you wouldn't have this social effect, right? Suddenly, it becomes one of the most famous paintings in the world. So this has been termed the Justin Timberlake effect. You know, someone whose music is objectively average being propelled to the top of the charts, largely probably by luck. If you were to reverse time for poor old Justin, he probably, in most worlds, wouldn't have got to the top. Let's be fair about it. So there's a nice article in the New York Times, which I think is freely available. Is Justin Timberlake a product of cumulative advantage? The idea here is that, you know, that first rating the song gets is hugely important. This is why people that put stuff on Amazon, or, you know, they get their friends to do the first few ratings, because people are so strongly influenced. You know, it's the rich get richer effect. Now, those of you who've been born into affluent families, who have had opportunities that others haven't had, this propels you in life, right? I'm afraid to say it's not about necessarily about your independent abilities. This cumulative advantage effect is hugely important in humans. There are other social factors, such as religion. I mean, again, religion, it's completely arbitrary. I mean, it's a superstition. It's completely arbitrary. And of course, when you look, for example, at the world Muslim population, you see it's diffused. It spreads among individuals. You can see this for all religions. So one of the sort of most fascinating questions is, regardless of which religion, are there benefits to this conformity of belief? Right? Objectively, of course, it doesn't really matter. But people subjectively really believe that their religion might be better or so on than someone else's. It just depends where you're born. But are there costs to nonconformity? Have we actually evolved to have these types of irrational beliefs? And so, in actual fact, there is some work that shows that there are direct benefits to having religious beliefs. For example, if you look at religious versus secular communes, controlling for the size and geographic location, and you look at the fraction surviving over time, the religious communes tend to survive much longer than the secular ones, suggesting there might actually be an adaptive reason to have such belief systems. Another nice example are the Quakers in the northeastern United States. Now, the Quakers were heavily involved in whaling, as were many other communities along that coast. But then when the whales became more and more rare, harder to find, and you had to go out at ship for years to go and find these whales, many of these communities failed, but the Quaker communities did not. Why is that? Well, the Quakers have and did have a culture whereby women were equal to men, and the women contributed enormously, for example, in banking, finances, and so on. They also did not discriminate against African Americans. And so something about their society caused their communities to survive these very hard times. So again, this could be a selection for types of belief systems. But, you know, this is not always a good thing, of course. You know, it could be arbitrary, it could be a bad thing. I mean, you have all sorts of weird normative behaviors, like foot binding in imperialist China that lasted for centuries, where women would bind their feet. This was considered attractive to wear these shoes. Lasted for centuries. Clearly disadvantageous. And clearly, I would say, unattractive to many people. Yet this was, of course, considered to be attractive because it was considered to be attractive, just as the Mona Lisa is famous for being famous. And actually, I'm going to play the sound here because this is a very disturbing but very important video for you to watch about this role of social influence. Let's see if this plays. So let me just set this up for you in a moment. So what's going on here is you're going to see an individual that's coming into a laboratory, and he or she believes that they're taking part in a valid scientific experiment. And they are asking general knowledge questions to someone that's in a different room, but they can hear that person. And if this person gets the questions wrong, they're instructed to give them electric shocks. Let's go back a sec. They're instructed to give them electric shocks. And the question then is, how far will they go? How far will they go if they're just pressured or pushed by the experimenter? And so you're seeing the perspective of the person asking the questions and then applying the electric shocks.
The victim is an accomplice of the experimenter. The victim, according to plan, provided many wrong answers. His verbal responses were standardized on tape, and each protest was coordinated to a particular voltage level on the shock generator. Now, as teacher, you were seated in front of this impressive-looking instrument, the shock generator. Its essential feature is a line of switches that goes from 15 volts to 450 volts and a set of verbal designations that goes from slight shock to moderate shock, strong shock, very strong shock, intense shock, extreme intensity shock, and finally XXX, danger severe shock. Your job, the experimenter explains to you, is to teach the learner a simple word pair test. If he gets each answer correctly, fine, you move on to the next pair. But if he makes a mistake, you are instructed to give an electric shock, starting with 15 volts. And you increase the shock one step on each error.
Incorrect. You'll now get a shock of 105 volts. Hard hit. Just how far can you go on this thing?
As far as necessary.
Maybe each party is necessary. Incorrect. 150 volts. Sad face.
That's all. Get me out of here. I told you I had heart trouble. I never saw anything to bother me now.
Wrong. It's hair. 75 volts.
Some psychologists were troubled by the ethics of it. Many, if not most, subjects found it a highly stressful, conflicted experience. People are stammering, stuttering, laughing hysterically and inappropriately.
180 volts.
According to Milgram, one of the things that's a prerequisite for carrying out acts that are evil is to shed responsibility from your shoulders and hand it over to the person in charge.
You're gonna get a shot. 180 volts.
Volunteers were prepared to administer a potentially fatal electric shock when encouraged to do so by what they perceived as a legitimate authority figure, in this case, a man in a white coat.
375 volts. I think sometimes in a following minute. I'll give no answer. He was hollering on less voltage. Can't you check in to see if he's all right, please?
Milgram's findings horrified America. They showed that decent American citizens were as capable of committing acts against their conscience as the Germans had been under the Nazis.
And so it's a really important experiment because it really shows that these types of processes, this type of social feedback, can lead to huge negative cultural changes. And that it's not like one type of person is more or less susceptible than another. And so this can happen anywhere, at any time in history. And in fact, you know, we can think to ourselves about what we're witnessing now with the spread of the far right, for example, in the United States and also even into Europe. You know, how important is social influence? Well, it's becoming increasingly important because not only do these individuals can they meet together, they can also find each other much more easily online. And so increasingly, you can have vocal minorities either on the far right or the far left that ordinarily wouldn't be able to find like-minded people, but they can do so in our modern world. And of course, there are also undecided individuals who can be influenced and swayed by the opinions that they hear around them. And processes like Facebook, Twitter, and so on allow for communication in ways that have never been possible before. And it's now thought that Twitter, for example, has been instrumental in spreading political ideology within the United States, and probably globally. It wasn't invented for that purpose, but it's seemingly had that purpose. And we all know about the challenges that Facebook has had in terms of posting news stories. And, of course, Russian involvement in those news stories in the US election. And so Joback Coleman is a PhD student in my group. And after Trump got elected, we were devastated and then wanted to suddenly try and understand how does this work? Why? How is political view associated with rational decision-making and collective intelligence? So we wanted to understand the relationship between confidence and knowledge. Because many of these people with very strong, for example, racist views are very confident in their views. That seems irrational, but they're very confident in their opinion. So we wanted also to discover how, or can we get more information on these sort of online networks as to how people are influenced? So of course we can't do an experiment like Stanley Milgram did. Ethically, that would never pass today. But we can do these types of experiments. And importantly, we wanted to look at how these factors differ across political groups. And so I'll give you, this is not published, this is all brand new work, we're going to submit this pretty soon, but I'll give you some of the key results that we found. So firstly, we had a very good representation from people who either were very conservative all the way to very liberal. It's not that there are that many very liberal or very conservative people, but we deliberately sampled so we had good representation across the political spectrum. And one thing we find is that the accuracy of general knowledge tended to be lower in the far right. All of the other groups was identical. We also find that all groups, except for the far right, the more accurate they are, this is in general knowledge, like what's the capital of New Jersey? Everyone tends to be more confident the more accurate they are. They tend to be well calibrated. You know if you've made a good guess, except for the far right. The far right, the more confident they are, we can predict that they're going to get it wrong. So they're completely miscalibrated. We do not know why. It's not associated with educational attainment, for example. Also, everyone behaves the same. They utilize positively social information to make better decisions, except the very conservatives, the far right. They don't use social information unless it's information that they already agree with, which of course gives them no benefit, especially since they tend to be less accurate. So there's really something fundamentally different. And also, when we allow individuals to form social networks, the far right form these echo chambers where this misinformation and this poor decision-making is perpetuated within this echo chamber. But remember, these people are very confident that they've got it right. But objectively, they haven't, because we've given them factual questions. So just a little hint of what's to come in terms of trying to understand these types of processes in humans. So the conclusions of our study so far is that the far right specifically overestimate their knowledge and their ability. They're not influenced by others if they disagree with them socially. And reducing diversity of opinions, of course, causes a degradation in the collective intelligence among such individuals. They make very irrational decisions, which they're very confident about. And so that concludes this part of the lecture, or in fact, most of the course. And so we've gone from trying to understand social factors among neurons and how this gives rise to individual intelligence and individual decision-making. Then we've spent a lot of time in our class talking about the evolution and mechanism of social behavior, all the way from very simple organisms up to relatively simple organisms like fish, all the way up to humans. So now what's going to happen is we're going to take a sort of 5-minute break, and then afterwards we're going to have a short talk by Simon Garnier, a professor at New Jersey Institute of Technology, who's visiting us, who's a world expert on collective behavior across these scales.
Today I'm going to give you, we have like 15 minutes, I'm going to give you a very quick overview of one of these two things. We have the choice between looking at amoebas that swarms and form structures with their own bodies, or looking at this weird creature that I call the blob, which is the slime mold physarum polycephalum. I think you talked a bit about both of them. So it's a kind of like choose your own adventure kind of mini lecture. So which one do you prefer? Who wants the swarm? Nobody wants the swarm. Who wants the blob? All right, we'll do the blob then. They're both good choices, so don't worry about it. All right, so this creature is called Physarum polycephalum, or slime mold. It's a weird creature. It's really, really, really weird. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what we do in my lab with this funky organism. But before I can talk about this, I need to give you a little bit of context of what we do and why we study this organism. We study this organism to understand something about how we make decisions. Right, so if you're in the environment and you try to figure out like what is the best restaurant around, you have two options. You can flip a coin and go with whatever random choice the coin has given you, or you go on Google or Yelp or other websites to try to gather information about these different restaurants or different options that you have. And you use this information to try to inform yourself about the best option that you have in the environment, right? You all do that, or you just pick restaurant at random? Okay, I'm gonna say you all do that. Now these things, looking for information before you actually take a decision, is something that we call the exploration-exploitation trade-off. I don't know if you've talked about this, but essentially the idea is you need to spend some time and some of your resources to gather information about the environment before you can actually exploit the environment, before you can move on to select the best option that you can based on your knowledge. And that's a problem that all of us have to do every day. Every time you make a decision that is informed by some information, you have to try to solve this problem. How much time are you going to spend increasing your knowledge before making a decision and actually acting on that knowledge? And in psychology and in cognitive sciences, this is tested using this paradigm called the multi-arm bandit problem. Do you know what an arm bandit is? Right, it's a slot machine at the casino. And the slot machine at the casino essentially, in case you don't go to the casino too often, works pretty simply. You pull the lever and then you have a certain probability of getting money out of that. Okay? Now, all the machines at the casino don't have the same odds. Some machines are more rewarding than others. And if you want to figure out which of the machines is the best, you're going to need to spend time trying all the machines one by one, several times, and every time you have to spend money to activate the machine. And then it's only after enough repetition of that you'll be able to decide which machine has the best probability of winning. Now, of course, that problem is a problem that it's been tested a lot in the animal kingdom. It's been tested with humans. It's been tested with birds. Pigeons are really, really good at it, apparently. Human beings also, we are very good at solving this problem. But one of the things that I'm really interested in is trying to understand our organisms that don't have brains. So I know you already made a joke about this guy. But organisms that don't have brains, which actually are most of the organisms on Earth. Most of the living kingdom is constituted of organisms like plants, bacteria, unicellulars that do not have a brain and do not have a centralized way of computing these probabilities. Okay, and that's what I call the Homer Simpson paradox. You know Homer Simpson? Yes. So Homer Simpson is an organism that is completely stupid. We can all agree on that. He's probably the stupidest human on Earth. Yet he is probably the most successful person you'll ever meet. This guy has been in space. He's met all the US presidents dead and alive. He's almost become world boxing champion. Right? He is an extremely, extremely successful organism, and yet he's not capable of thinking very, very far. Okay? Now, that's where we come back to slime mold. Slime mold is like Homer Simpson. It's yellow, and it doesn't look very smart. It's an organism, as you can see here, that is essentially bright yellow. You can find this in the temperate forest in Europe and the America. And this entire mass of yellow goo that you see here is actually one single cell, right? You can't even see your cells. Your own cells are so too small to see them. This is a cell you can see with the naked eye. You can grow these cells up to a square meter. It's a massive, massively huge cell. But what's interesting for me, there's a problem with my presentation. Jump here. What's interesting for me is that this big cell is actually capable of solving pretty complex problem. So for instance, in this experiment done by Nakagaki in Japan, the slime mold is capable of finding the shortest path inside this little maze. Just to give you a sense of how difficult the task is, it takes kids, you need to have a kid about 3-4 years old before it's capable of solving this problem. So essentially, it's the slime mold, which doesn't have a brain, doesn't have neurons, doesn't have a centralized way of computing information, is capable of solving a task that a three-year-old will not be able to do. Okay? So it's also capable of solving problems like optimizing information networks. So that's an experiment done by, again, Nakagaki's lab, where these represent the coast of Japan, off the city of Tokyo, which is represented here. And all of these different little dots here are actually food items that the slime mold can connect with its body. And the network that it forms between these food items actually has network property like robustness and efficiency that are very close to the actual train system in the Tokyo area. So right, we have an organism here which doesn't have a brain, again, doesn't have neurons, doesn't have a centralized way of computing information, and it's capable of optimizing very complex problems like building networks that are actually very robust and very efficient at the same time. Now, that's what was done in Japan. What we do in my lab is we're trying to see if the slime mold can solve this problem of the multi-arm bandit problem. Can you take slime mold, bring it to the casino, and can it find the best slot machine for you? Okay? And the way we do this, we, of course, the slime mold cannot actuate the slot machine. We actually have designed an experiment where the slime mold starts in the center of this world, and the slime mold can move into two directions. Each of these directions represents, if you want, one of the slot machines. Every time you have a white bar, it means the slot machine doesn't give you anything. Every time you have a brown bar here, the slot machine actually pays something back. Okay? You understand the experiment? And what we can vary on all these different versions of the experiment is how often do you win on the left and the right, and how much you obtain in total reward on the left and the right of the slot machine. So essentially, the slime mold here is comparing two slot machines and trying to figure out which one is the best one. So these are all the people who were involved in that study, but I'm just going to show you the experiment. So that's how it looks like in reality. So the slime mold starts at the center and then can explore in both directions. So it tests both machines at the beginning, and you can see that after a certain time, the slime mold stops moving into one direction, it stops moving in this direction, and only exploit that direction. Okay? So the slime mold is capable of choosing, if you want, one of the two options. Now the question is it choosing the best of the two options? You can see in the results here, the results represent essentially the difference between the position of the front of the slime mold on the left and the right side. If the dots are above this line, it means it's moving toward the best option. And you can see that in all the experiments that we've done, whether in this case they are simple choices, difficult choices, or very, very difficult choices, and we increase the difficulty, the slime mold, after a period of exploration, always ends up choosing the best of the two options. Right? And it's something quite remarkable. It's capable of doing this between 75 and 90% of the time. It's going to choose the best option out of this random world that we give it. And just for comparison, this is about as good as the pigeon and slightly less good as a human being. Right? So this slime mold is capable of solving this problem of finding the best slot machine in the casino as good as you. I'm not impressed by this. And we have like 5 minutes?
Yep.
5 minutes. Now the question is, how does it do it? Right? Because that's what we want to know. It's capable of doing it, but if we don't understand how it does it, it's not very interesting. Now there's multiple ways you can solve this problem. And these are all the different strategies, or the most common strategies that you can solve this problem. All these strategies, I know their equations, it's scary, but it's not very complicated. What they represent here are different strategies to solve the problem. At the top of the list are all the dumb strategies, the ones that don't work, like autocorrelation. Autocorrelation means if you decided to go to the right side, then you keep going to the right side. So you make a choice randomly, it's like flipping a coin, okay? Entire autocorrelation is the solution where you start going left and then right and then left and then right and then left and right. So you keep exploring, you never make a choice. But all the other strategies actually will end up making a choice for one of the two arms. And the question is, which of the strategies is the slime mold using? You haven't done Bayesian analysis or this kind of thing, so I'm going to skip the math. But essentially, the best strategy that we obtain is what it's called relative successes. Relative successes, I'm going to explain very quickly what it means. It simply means that you move or you make your decision, it's a probability is in proportion to the number of time you've been rewarded in one direction. Does it make sense? So it means essentially that you ignore every time you fail. All you do is count how many times you succeed. If you succeed 10 times on this machine, only 2 times on this machine, then you're 5 times more likely to choose that machine than this machine. Okay? And that's very, very clever strategy, actually. It's a very simple strategy to implement. You only need to count every time you succeed. But it's also a strategy that guarantees that you never stop exploring. Right? Because you don't take into account failures, you spend your time exploring until you reach a success or you die. That's what nature does best, die. Okay? And what's interesting also is if you look at the complexity in terms of the computational power that you require to compute a strategy, it's certainly not the most complicated, but it's not also the simplest. So the slime mold is doing something computationally that is a little more than just random choice. It's something that is actually requires some ability to implement, to integrate information in a very, very clever way. Now, to get at how it's capable of implementing this, we've designed this experiment where this is a single tubule of slime mold. This is for scale about 2.5 centimeters in length. And what you can see in this little video here, all these little dots represent actually the width of the tubule. This tubule keeps pumping and pumping and pumping all the time. This pumping is actually allowing the slime mold to move biomass from one side of its body to the other one, right? It's like when you swallow food, right? The food goes down one direction. It's a peristaltic behavior. And that's exactly the same thing. It allows you to push food or push nutrient from one side to the other of this tubule. But we can record this pumping behavior, and you can record it close to the best food source or away from the best food source. And you can see there's a clear difference between the pumping behavior close to the food source, to the best food source, which is very strong, from the pumping behavior from the close to the worst food source here, which is very weak. Now, what we can do also is we can manipulate this pumping behavior. We have actually this little machine here, which essentially compress the tubule. So we can create artificial pumping. We can artificially talk to the slime mold if you want. And when you do this, when you compress one of these tubules, when you compress one of the parts of the slime mold regularly at regular intervals, that creates a reaction. The slime mold start to come towards you. So we can actually talk to it and tell it, here is the good food. Well, actually, in this case, there's absolutely nothing in that location. We can trick the slime mold into thinking there is food where we pushed on it. And that combined with information that we get now from cell and molecular biology, and this is the inside of the slime mold. What you're seeing is actually every bit of color is a piece of food that it has captured. And we can start measuring how fast it moves this food from one side to the other, and whether or not when it decides to go for the best food source, it actually decides based on information that are circulating within the slime mold or actually information circulating outside the slime mold when we compress the membrane. And this is my little Twitter, because it's a social behavior class, a little Twitter summary of this. Right, the slime mold ignores failure and always focuses on successes when playing slot machine in Las Vegas. And that's a strategy you should be using next time you go to the casino. And that will be it. It's 1:15.
Thank you very much.
I couldn't do faster than that. Thank you.
Okay, well, that concludes our class. Thanks very much for taking the class. If you've got any questions about the exam or whatever, just email. But it's pretty standard. It's, series of questions, there's no tricks, there's nothing
what?
Sophisticated.
No tricks?
Well, not liberally. double bluff. But yeah, just if you've got any questions, just email us.
Thank you.